From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Monday, the 14th of October, 2019. So glad to have you with us this morning. We have a full show lined up here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM and AM. And going to be starting out with a conversation with Peter Galbraith, someone who's worn a lot of hats in his life, including a diplomat who was traveling extensively over in the part of the Middle East that is occupied by the Kurds, who a lot of folks think were left dangling last week when President Trump announced he was going to be downgrading the U.S. presence, eliminating really the U.S. presence, from what I can understand, in northern Syria. In the second half hour of this morning's program, we're going to be hearing from an official at the State Department of Health about warnings of a chemical in paint thinner that is apparently quite dangerous and is something you probably want to get rid of if you have it in your basement or your garage or whatever. And we'll be hearing from Pam Wadman of the Health Department about that in the 9:30 to 10 block. In the latter hour of the program this morning, David Mears is going to be stopping by. He's the former commissioner of Department of Environmental Conservation in our fair state of Vermont. And these days, he is the executive director of the National Audubon Society's chapter in Vermont. He is quite concerned about the potential impacts of climate change on our bird populations. Many, many people, of course, love our birds. Big bird watching is big business in Vermont. People out there looking for common loons and hermit thrushes and all the other great birds we have in our woods and our shorelines and so on. And Mr. Mears is quite concerned about their future. We'll be hearing from him in the second hour on that. But I wanted to start out this morning with a very serious situation unfolding over in northeastern Syria, involving the Kurds, who were fighting shoulder to shoulder with the United States against ISIS and the ISIS caliphate. And last week, in a rather sudden announcement, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, announced that the U.S. troops would be withdrawing from there and pretty much leaving the Kurds to their own devices. And who better in Vermont to talk about all this than somebody who's had extensive experience in that part of the world, both in business and in diplomacy. And Peter Galbraith joins me on the telephone this morning from his home in southern Vermont. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Dave.
Thank you very much for joining me this morning. So I just wanted to find out from you your thoughts on all of this. Are the Kurds going to be able to survive?
In Syria, that's very uncertain. Just by way of background, I was in northeast Syria at the end of September with Bernard Kouchner, who's a friend. He's the founder of Doctors Without Borders and former foreign minister of France. I think this is my 14th trip there since 2014, been trying to help the Syrian Kurds figure out how to negotiate, since U.S. support was always very uncertain. They needed to figure out how they could negotiate with the Syrian government and secure some level of autonomy. But then, and the other thing they had asked us to do was to figure out how to deal with the children of the Islamic State, who are in three camps in northeast Syria, in the camps. The Kurds are doing the best they can. They weren't getting any support. And the largest of the camp, Al-Hol, has effectively been taken over by ISIS women who threaten to radicalize the children, grow up another generation of jihadis, as well as are terrorizing the less radical women. So that was the what I'd been doing just a couple of weeks ago. But of course, on Sunday, Trump spoke a week ago with the Turkish president. He didn't just decide to withdraw. He actually gave the Turks a green light to invade, claiming that the U.S. had no interest in what happened to the Kurds, and that Turkey would take care of the ISIS prisoners. Well, a couple of days later, Turkey did, in fact, invade. Hundreds of lives have been lost. All the main Kurdish cities, Qamishli, Kobani, Amudey, are right on the border. If you're there in those cities, you just see the wall that separates them from Turkish cities, actually, on the other side. So when Turkey comes across the border, it's coming right into the populated areas that are where the Kurds live, and they've been shelling and bombing and now sent in troops. Then the United States, after that happened, the Defense Secretary announced on Friday, I guess, that the United States was simply going to withdraw, and it's been a chaotic withdrawal. It in many ways resembles, for those who are your age and mine, Dave, the way it was in 1975 when we pulled out of Vietnam. Of course, Turkey has not secured the ISIS prisoners. The U.S. was unable to secure them. About 700 women escaped from the Aynisa camp, and these are radical ISIS women. There's a great likelihood that many of the ISIS fighters will now escape. The Kurds held about 10,000 ISIS fighters, the CIA has estimated there are about 14,000 ISIS fighters still at large. So if 10,000 escape, you're going to almost double the strength of ISIS. And of course, if the U.S. then finds itself again having to fight the Islamic State, and remember, the Islamic State doesn't just confine its activities to Syria and Iraq, it engages in bombings in Europe, and obviously there's a potential for terrorist acts in our own country. But if the fighters escape and the U.S. ends up having to fight them again, guess what? The United States is not going to have any allies. And just to understand what that means, in northeast Syria, in the 5 years since the U.S. began to support the Syrian Kurds, 5 American servicemen lost their lives in hostile circumstances. 11,000 Kurds were killed.
Now, I just want to extend to our listeners some background knowledge here about your own credibility in this part of the world. I was reading up a little bit last night and reminded that you were a Senate aide back in the late 1980s and actually traveled to northern Iraq, and you were meeting with the Kurdish folks over there, and were able to smuggle documents out of Iraq that proved Saddam Hussein's culpability in the gassing of Kurdish civilians, and something that is quite extraordinary. And actually, you seem to get a lot of credit for exposing to the world Saddam Hussein's crimes back in the almost 30 years ago, or really 30 and then some years ago. Now, and so you've been around that part of the world for, in and out of there for quite a long time.
Yes. My first trip out of there was actually in 1984. But in 1987, when I was with the staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, we were looking at the Iran-Iraq War, which was still going on. And I went up into northern Iraq, when I crossed from the Arab part of Iraq to the Kurdish part, there was something really remarkable that struck me, which is the villages that were on our maps weren't there. And then we could see that Saddam was in the process of destroying them. Yeah. And in the end, he destroyed every village in Kurdistan, about 5,000 of them, relocated the Kurds to concentration camps. A year later, with my associate on the committee staff, Chris Van Hollen, who's now the U.S. Senator from Maryland, we went along the entire length of the Iraq-Turkey border, documenting the, interviewing the survivors of the chemical weapons attacks.
Wow. And your You also have done some business over there, for which I want our listeners to have the full picture here. You have come in for some criticism for, I guess, and I saw one piece in Forbes where the person was essentially saying you shouldn't mix diplomacy and business. You were representing, I believe, a Norwegian oil company in that part of the world, and with a lot of money at stake. And what if anything, do you want to tell folks about that?
Well, first, I was never a U.S. diplomat in Iraq, so I was never mixing diplomacy and business. And I was retired from government. The Kurds had wanted to develop. Part of the reason that Iraq had been able to press the Kurds is that the Kurds had no independent resources. So, more or less at their request, I brought in and helped arrange for a very responsible oil company to come in, and indeed the company did well.
Mm-hmm.
It opened up a whole oil industry in Kurdistan. Now, I know folks in Vermont don't on the whole like the oil industry.
Fossil fuels.
What I can tell you is it's around, and it's going to be around for a while. And from an environmental point of view, it's far better to extract it in places where it's easily extracted than it is, say, in Canadian oil sands, where it has disastrous environmental consequences. Again, I share the view that the world is, if we're going to survive as a planet, we need to move away from oil. But that isn't going to happen all overnight, and therefore it's better to remove it where it's going to cause the least environmental damage. But also, it enabled the people of Iraqi Kurdistan to develop what is now a de facto independent state, and which I hope someday will become a fully independent state.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect of this whole thing, too. I was reading that Kurdistan is sometimes described, or really the Kurds are described as the largest ethnic group in the world that does not have a country.
Yeah, they used to say that the phrase was after the Ukrainians. The Kurds are the largest ethnic group without their own country. And in September of 1991, I was in Iraqi Kurdistan in the safe area that had been created after the first Gulf War, in a very remote corner with a tribal sheikh. And one of his Peshmerga, his fighters, was listening to the BBC radio as the news came from Kiev that Ukraine had declared independence. So I turned to the sheikh and I said, I just want to be the first person to congratulate you on the day in which the Kurds have become the largest people in the world without their own country.
Wow.
But you know, the things have evolved. The Iraqi constitution in 2005 gives the Kurds almost de facto independence. Kurdish law supersedes Iraqi law in almost all areas. They have their own army. They have their own visa system. And in September 25th of 2017, they held a referendum on independence, and the population voted 93% for independence.
Now, how does that affect the Kurdish population across the border in Turkey?
People make the assumption that if the Kurds want to have their own state in one of the Kurds live in four countries.
Mm-hmm.
So the largest number are in Turkey, about 20 million. Second largest in Iran, about 10 million. Third in Iraq, maybe 6 million. And the fourth, about 3 million in Syria.
And draw a map. Are these contiguous parts of these four countries?
They are contiguous. So,
okay.
Basically... When at the end of the First World War, when the new lines were drawn of the old Ottoman Empire, they simply divided up Kurdistan. Of course, the Iranian part had always been separate. And what people need to understand about the Kurds is that they're not Arabs, they're not Turks. Kurdish is an Indo-European language, which is perhaps not that close, but more closely related to Farsi, or what's spoken in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And they have those Zoroastrian origins. But they're, you know, they're very different from the Turks, who of course speak a Turkic language, and the Arabs, who speak a Semitic language.
Yep.
For the entire history of Iraq, and for that matter, which is 100 years old, of modern Syria, they've been oppressed in Iraq in the 1980s. It was a genocide, systematic destruction of villages, use of poison gas, rounding people up into concentration camps, taking them to the south of Iraq where there were mass killings. And in Syria, the Syrian regime basically denied the Kurds an identity and citizenship. It said they aren't really Syrian citizens. And, of course, the name of the country in Syria is the Syrian Arab Republic. Well, if you're a Kurd, that sort of means it doesn't include you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think we just have a few more minutes to go, but I wanted to ask you to map out a future here. What should happen now in this part of the world? I mean, if you were to, you know, somebody says, Peter Galbraith, you're in charge now of this mess, what would you do?
Well, I think where you have people who almost in a geographically defined area who almost unanimously want their own state, then you have to accept that. And sooner or later, it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, while people say the independence of Iraqi Kurdistan would be destabilizing, it's actually holding Iraq together that's been destabilizing, a source of enormous violence. In Syria, something urgent needs to happen now, which Trump, having opened the door to a Turkish invasion, to the destruction of the people who fought side by side with us, now putting American servicemen and women at risk, because if there's a new battle, we won't have allies. And the people who took 11,000 casualties in the battle that we were part of just aren't going to be there. And has revitalized ISIS. We need to stop the Turkish invasion. And Senator Chris Van Hollen and Lindsey Graham have legislation to impose sanctions on Turkey. I think that needs to happen. But more than that, we need to go to the UN Security Council under Chapter 7, which is the binding requirements, and order Turkey to leave. And then, of course, if Turkey doesn't leave, take the next step and have UN sanctions on Turkey. And, you know, all this calls into question the future of NATO. Turkey's a NATO ally, but as the Secretary of Defense said, it's not much of an ally.
Yeah.
And you kind of wonder whether Trump's agenda here, because he's always disliked NATO, isn't, in fact, to also destroy NATO by forcing Turkey out. So he destroys one ally, the Kurds, and another ends the alliance with Turkey. It's quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, it struck me for a while that that the United States has been in a weird predicament or position where it has this formal alliance via NATO with Turkey. It is also allied de facto, certainly, and perhaps more formally as well, with the Kurds, and the Turkey and the Turks and the Kurds are so vehemently at odds with one another. It has put the U.S. in a sort of weird position all along, hasn't it?
It has, but we should be a little careful about taking what Erdogan, the Turkish president, says at face value. Turkey describes the Syrian Kurds as terrorists, as the same as the PKK, which is the a Kurdish insurrection in Turkey that's fought since 1984. So it's a 35-year insurrection in Turkey. Turkey considers the PKK to be a terrorist group. Actually, so does the U.S. and the European Union. I think it would be fairer to say that they were, again, rebels rather than terrorists. At one point they sought independence. Now they just seek, Kurdish rights.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are connections, but Turkey itself had been meeting with all the Syrian Kurdish leaders inside Turkey until 2014. There's something a bit disingenuous in Turkey's characterization that it's going in to fight terrorists. And furthermore, the way in which virtually every ISIS fighter got to Syria, the foreign fighters, is through Turkey.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Turkey simply facilitated access to Syria by people who went there to, you know, create the Islamic State, to do crucifixions, to behead hostages, to, you know, kidnap and rape Yazidi women. So.
Yeah. Now the and by the way, you mentioned the children in these camps. They are actually, I guess, largely the children of these rapes by ISIS fighters of Yazidi women. Is that right?
There are. I was concerned with three different categories of children.
Mm-hmm.
There are about 200 children who are the product of the rapes of these Yazidi girls and women, and some of these girls were really quite young. And they, when the Kurds found the Yazidis in the camp, because they were, you know, they were sex slaves, and they were taken with the ISIS fighters. When the ISIS was finally defeated, it lost its last territory. These women ended up with the other women in the camps, and then the Kurds began to figure out who were Yazidis.
Mm-hmm.
They took them out of the camp, and they took their children out of the camp. But the problem was that the Yazidis, it's a separate religion, a very old religion, and it's considered, the Muslims consider them to be devil worshippers, which they're not, but it's complicated. And so the only way the Yazidis have survived over the centuries is that they do not allow marriage outside the community. They do not allow sexual relations outside the community. They do not allow conversions. And so the Yazidis made a huge change by saying that these raped girls and women could come back to the community, but they couldn't bring their children. And so these poor girls had the choice between, you know, staying in Syria in the ISIS camps or returning to their communities, and most of them chose to return to their communities, and so they had to leave their children behind. The Kurds did take the children out of the camps. So that was the first group of children that I was trying to help. I was doing this with Bernard Kouchner, the founder of Doctors Without Borders. Those we wanted to get to Iraqi Kurdistan and then possibly international adoption. Well, that's no longer possible because the borders are closed by the Turks. The second category, there are about 600 orphans of foreign fighters in the camps being cared for by other women.
Yeah.
The trouble is if the children stay in the camps, which are run by the most radical ISIS women, they're going to grow up to be the next generation of jihadis, of suicide bombers, of murderers, of rapists. And that's bad for the children. It's bad for everybody else, too.
Yeah.
So we wanted to get the orphans out. And then ultimately, we were wrestling with the issue, do we separate the children from their mothers? And in those circumstances, I think that probably was the thing that had to happen. But again, this is all overtaken by events. The camps are likely to fall into the hands of the Syrian government. The Syrian government is likely to execute the women, and who knows what's going to happen to the children.
Wow. You know, I guess when we think about this razor's edge of a situation over there, you know, this dual alliance with the Turks and the Kurds, this idea that the United States troops who were there until a week ago were active there, were kind of sitting on a powder keg and, you know, trying to keep the fuse from being lit. All of a sudden, they go away. In order for this extraction of U.S. military forces to happen, it would have to be done in an extremely skilled and delicate manner, wouldn't it?
Yes. They obviously have aircraft, helicopters, so you can fly them out across northeast Syria to Iraqi Kurdistan. That's essentially what's happening.
Yeah.
But you can also, you could also, at least from the eastern part of the Syrian Kurdish area, they could still reach Iraqi Kurdistan by road and convoys. The Turks have reached the M4 highway, which is the east-west highway. And so for those that are in the western part around Kobani, if your listeners think of the map of Syria, it would be in the middle of the, along the northern border, about halfway between the Mediterranean and Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Those people, and that's where the main base was, those no longer have a land route. Not only that, but Turkey shelled the American base.
Peter, I hate to do this, but we are about out of time, unfortunately. There's a lot to unravel here, and I'd love to have you back and get Chapter 2 in sometime in the coming days, maybe in the next week or so. But thank you very much for your helping us at least get Chapter 1. So thanks for joining me this morning.
Good talking to you.
Peter Galbraith, former U.S. diplomat and longtime participant in politics over there in the Middle East.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toten Coat, fashion forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back continuing our program this Monday morning, and going to shift gears now to a different topic, also a pretty serious one. This one, though, maybe closer to home, as close perhaps as your basement or your shed or wherever else you keep things like old cans of paint thinner, because I saw this rather striking news release last week from the Vermont Department of Health and Agency of Natural Resources, Department of Environmental Conservation, I also understand, has been involved in a decision to put out this announcement about something called methylene chloride. This is a chemical that is an ingredient in some paint thinners and coating strippers and things like that, which the EPA announced this past March it was going to essentially ban in the United States. They have discovered that this stuff is not really suitable for the uses to which it was being put anyway, and it should not be out there, apparently, in general circulation. The EPA, which, remember, you know, in recent years has not been, it's had a reputation for not being a super aggressive regulator, shall we say, but in March they put out a final rule to prohibit the manufacture, importation, processing, and distribution of methylene chloride in all paint removers for consumer use. The restrictions go into effect November 22nd, a little more than a month from now, and officials are urging folks who have any products in their homes containing methylene chloride to contact your local solid waste district for when and where hazardous waste collection is available. Methylene chloride is typically listed as an ingredient on the container. Do not dispose of these products in your drain, trash, or anywhere in the environment. So wanted to bring in Pam Wadman. She is with the Vermont Department of Health and is a senior environmental risk assessor, which would seem like a job title directly on something like this. And I believe Pam Wadman is with us on the phone. Good morning, Pam.
Yes, I am. Hi, Dave.
Hi. And so am I right that this is... This struck me as an unusual announcement in its sort of emphasis and clarity and seriousness. Is that a fair description?
I would say, well, yes, this has been studied for a really long time, and we're very clear on the effects of methylene chloride. We've got so much evidence for people who've been using it as a chemical paint stripper have accidentally died after being overcome by the fumes. So wow. We've got at least 20 people in the past 20 years in the United States that have been overcome by methylene chloride using it as a paint stripper. So now it's banned from that use due to this new EPA ruling. So, yes, it's been since 2014 that they have undertaken this action to ban this chemical from consumer use. Not only is it acutely toxic, and that's the reason they gave us the ban, but also even long-term low-level exposure is very bad for your health. We know it's carcinogenic. It also can have non-cancer effects on your heart and your liver, and also your nervous system. So basically, this is not a good chemical, and it's really great to take it out of circulation by bringing it to the hazardous waste management district.
How much will the paint thinner industry and consumers who want an effective stripper when they are going out to buy these products at the hardware store, how much will they miss this stuff? Has it been an important ingredient just from the point of view of sort of effectiveness?
Yeah, it is true that it's a very effective paint stripper. It's a very effective solvent, which is part of the reason why it's so toxic. And basically, there are alternatives. There's some alternatives that are also toxic, the NMP and methylpyrrolidine, which is also going to be considered for a ban. But there are less toxic alternatives to choose. And basically, it's a matter of time. So if a person can be patient and let their paint stripper do the work, that's the way we prefer to do it rather than using a hazardous chemical.
I remember, years ago, I first probably became familiar with this kind of stuff as a kid, just helping around the house with paint projects and so on. And then, you grow up and get your own house maybe or whatever and occasionally you have cause to want to use a paint thinner. And if I remember right, the big one was turpentine. Is that still in use much? And if so, what's up with turpentine? Is that worrisome at all?
Mm. I remember turpentine too, and back in the old days in creosote.
Yeah,
turpentine is still used. Mm-hmm. Any of these solvents are present a potential health risk. Any of these solvents, you will inhale them. They can cause effects on your nervous system and your liver. And so, anytime you use any of these, you should have very good ventilation.
Mm-hmm.
But at relative risk, I'm not prepared to talk about that right now.
Yeah, I see. Okay. Yeah.
You can certainly still get turpentine. And also, just sanding. If you need to strip some paint, mechanical stripping is also a good way. Or you can bring it to a commercial paint stripper and have them do it for you where they can control the emissions of the fumes.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. They talked about, this release talked about effectively banning the sale and use of methylene chloride in consumer settings, which I gather that's mainly homeowners, but are there industrial or professional applications where this stuff will be continued to be used?
Yeah, that's going to be, there's a program to regulate that through EPA. If you could contact the Department of Environmental Conservation, they're more involved in how they regulate ongoing use of chemicals.
Okay.
But they will still be available for commercial use.
Yes, and it sounds to me like if you are, say, a professional painter and you have used products containing methylene chloride, you should probably stop using them, number one. Number two, you should probably be in touch with the DEC about what products are still out there, what their toxicity profiles are and that sort of thing. Is that right?
We do have to worry about people who are occupationally exposed to these chemicals. There is a known demonstrated increase in cancer risk, and we do know from anecdotal information about people who use them as hobbyists where they can have health effects also from using these chemicals. So also something you should always talk to your healthcare provider about. And as far as alternatives go, it's always they can just contact the DEC. I'm not sure how to answer that question.
Okay. I also wanted to invite listeners, if you have questions that Pam Wadman from the Health Department, Senior Environmental Risk Assessor, might be able to answer, you're welcome to give us a ring, 244-1777. is the local number here in Waterbury. The toll-free number is 1-877-291-8255. And so Pam, have you been sort of watching the development of this regulation and kind of just hoping that it would be handed down soon enough that you could put out an announcement like this?
Certainly, we've been watching it. It's been so long in the coming. And I think that consumers are also been aware that we've been planning on banning the methylene chloride and paint stripper for so many years. I think, honestly, what urged the EPA to take action was mothers of victims of this acute poisoning. Apparently, what I read, three people had gone in and petitioned Congress to say, please do something about this. Our children are dying.
Yeah.
So, and this is what got them to actually take action. From my perspective, I'm more worried about the chronic low-term risks, people who may not die immediately from using these, but develop chronic health effects that are related to this exposure. So that's more of, from my perspective, an interesting toxicological perspective. Acute toxicity, it's done and done. And part of the thing with they get overcome with fumes, there's not enough oxygen to breathe, so it's not necessarily chemical. It's just there's not enough oxygen. There's too much methylene chloride in the air.
Wow. I mean, that's it's a scary thing to think about. I would think if you're using this stuff and you start to feel a certain way, basically get away from it and get yourself out into some fresh air. And describe the way that people might feel if they're starting to get an ill health effect here.
Well, we have heard anecdotally that the people get tingling and numbness and maybe some nausea. Of the people that died, they usually passed out and then continued to be exposed after they passed out and were found. And
yikes.
This has happened enough times to know. It's when you're in a small space that the fumes can create those concentrations that are that high. Even people who are wearing proper respiratory protection have been overcome because the fumes just get into that high concentration. It's a very volatile chemical.
Wow. And one of the things that I hear, I've heard this more often actually in connection with pesticides and herbicides and other toxic chemicals that end up getting into the environment, is that there hasn't been as much testing before going to market with a new chemical as you might have wished for. And is that the same? Does the same kind of phenomenon of really not much upfront regulation does that play out here?
I would not agree with that. No, because we've been using, this is a very, very simple molecule. It's not unknown. There's no secrets here. We know what's going on. In fact, we've got a lot of evidence from both human and animal exposure. So it's not a mystery chemical, and it doesn't persist in the environment. So I don't think there was any mistake here. We found it was useful. It's not a persistent chemical. It doesn't bioaccumulate. So there's some things about this that are not bad. Although when it volatilizes, it is a greenhouse gas. But so we want to remove it from circulation. But I wouldn't say it was a failure of foresight in that it's been used all this time.
Okay, I'm sure you've heard that other critique about some chemicals that are put into commercial use and actually used by consumers. And it's discovered later that there are ill health effects, that they do bioaccumulate, there are other problems. And then people, especially on the environmental end of the spectrum, often kind of point at this and they say, gee whiz, we ought to have a better system in our country for basically vetting these materials before they get out, as opposed to making the society at large just a bunch of guinea pigs and we end up, concerned about it later.
Well, I agree with you. We're trying to do our best. That the EPA and the Toxic Substance Control Act and the Frank Gutenberg reform of the TSCA policy, they're working on it. Although the speed with which these things happen is not very quick.
Well, yeah, there is that.
But we're at the state level, we're trying to be proactive and trying to, we have a program for safer chemicals in children's products. And at the state of Vermont, we're trying to be proactive and protect our consumer health.
Pam Wadman, I was noticing that actually the release goes into some detail here about what folks should do if they find a jar of bottle of paint remover or whatever on a shelf, and it contains methylene chloride. Homeowners should contact their local solid waste district, and businesses that use methylene chloride, it says that they can contact Project WorkSafe rather for more information. So there's some guidance there for folks who are probably actually getting more frequent and more concentrated exposures in this stuff if they are in a business that uses the uses materials like this on a routine basis. I mean, homeowners are going to be, as you said, they can have acute toxicity, and anybody can be running into problems with this, but a typical homeowner might use paint thinner, what, once every couple of years or something, right?
Right. If they would prefer to use a safer alternative, they do have safer alternatives. Mm-hmm. In most cases, that would be a good idea. We just like to get this stuff, you know, safely disposed of. If they just leave it on their shelf, we don't know. 10 years from now, it might still be on that shelf. So it's kind of a better idea just to get rid of it now while it's fresh on their minds and the ban has just started.
Yeah. This may be beyond your bailiwick, and I'm happy to have you say so if it is, but I wonder whether folks are confident in Vermont's system for, I mean, say I contact my local solid waste district and I bring them a jug of paint thinner containing methylene chloride on their hazardous waste collection day. Does Vermont have a good system for then taking that material and making sure that it is disposed of properly?
I hate to speak beyond what I'm actually allowed to speak about. That would be under the purview of the Department of Environmental Conservation, but I am 100% confident that those programs take back the chemicals and deal with them properly.
Okay. I think it's good advice just coming from kind of an informed consumer too. So that's helpful.
Well managed.
I'm not trying to get you out over your skis. I apologize if it has seemed that way a couple times here, but the chemicals that are of concern here, are there others that are kind of next on the list? Is there anything else out there that's the kind of, you know, next month's methylene chloride?
Yeah. Well, at the same time, this is only a ban for the methylene chloride, but the N-methylpyrrolidone is, we call it NMP for short, mm-hmm. and that's also is next in line for the most effective paint stripper, and also next in line to be banned.
Wow.
That one presents reproductive risks as a, I haven't gone into great detail on that research for this conversation, but
yep,
I know
yep.
it's not being banned at this point in time, although we'd kind of prefer if you choose one that's less toxic. So there's a whole line of products that will be sold as greener alternatives, and they are benzyl alcohol-based strippers.
Hmm. Okay.
So if you want to use a chemical stripper, one of those, I don't want to promote any particular product, but Citrus Strip, I believe it's called, and mm-hmm. there's some orange products that are based on benzyl alcohol chemistry, which is a lot less toxic. It just takes more time.
I see.
So
yeah.
It's just a matter of letting the chemical do its job rather than having to rush it and use a dangerous chemical, hazardous to the environment and human health. Instead, we just take your time and use a safer product.
All right. Hey, we have a caller on the line. Let's go to Sam in Williston. Good morning, Sam.
Good morning. This is a pretty important topic you're bringing up. There have been a lot of deaths related to this, especially with homeowners when they get themselves into a tight area using this product and with no, mm-hmm. no fresh airflow. And it's been a real concern. But the other thing is when we do bring things back to the people that take care of this, we should be bringing them the SDS with us so they have an idea, you know, what PPE they should be using before handling the products we bring into them.
Sam, I'm sorry, you were getting a little fuzzy on me there for a minute. We should bring something along with the product. Is that?
When you buy things, you should get an SDS, safety data sheet from the people you're buying the product.
Okay.
And then when you return it and you're going to dispose of it, especially in this situation, maybe you just highlight it to them, let them know what's in it. I mean, give those people a break when you bring the thing back to make sure they understand that you're bringing in something that could potentially be dangerous to them.
Yeah, that's actually, yeah. I mean, that's a good point. I would guess that they kind of, if you're running a hazardous waste collection day or something for your local solid waste management district, it seems like you'd be on high alert just about pretty much everything. You'd be checking.
You would be, but especially when you're talking about inhalants.
Yeah, yeah.
In that scenario, if they start to, you know, open things up, and next thing you know, you got to trash it.
And even if you've already gotten a safety warning, it certainly doesn't hurt to hear it again. So, extra coat of paint, so to speak. What would you say, Pam, to that bit of advice from Sam?
I'd say it's really important always to keep things in their original container.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's a rule of thumb, and it's a good time to repeat that now.
Yeah,
especially when it goes to disposing of hazardous waste. So try to keep things in their original container.
All right.
For the hazmat people.
Well, that's about all the time we have on this segment of the Dave Graham Show for this morning. Pam Wadman of the Vermont Department of Health, thank you very much for joining me this morning. This is an important topic, and I'm glad to get some information about it out there.
Thank you, Dave.
All righty. We are, and thank you for the call, Sam. I appreciate it. We are going to be going out to a little break for some CBS News at the top of the hour here, and back with more of the Dave Graham Show to follow. We're going to be talking with David Mears of the National Audubon Society's Vermont chapter about our bird populations and what they might face in an era of climate change. Stay with us, folks. More interesting conversation to come, I'm sure, and as always, we'll welcome your calls after the break. Be back shortly.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely, lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
News Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
And we are back, continuing into our second hour on this Monday morning, the 14th of October, 2019, and I want to introduce my next guest. We're going to talk about birds in Vermont and what birds might face with habitat loss and climate change being twin issues for them. David Mears is the head of the Vermont Audubon, I'm sorry, the National Audubon Society's Vermont chapter, and Bridget Butler of St. Albans is calls herself the bird diva. She's been involved for decades now in Vermont in promoting the idea that folks need to care about our wild populations, especially of birds. And so I want to thank the two of you for coming into the studio this morning.
Huzzah. It's great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
And Bridget, let me start with you if I could. Audubon is, you worked for Audubon for a while in Vermont, correct?
Yes.
And you are someone who is interested in getting the word out about the effects of these two twin issues that are facing some of our bird populations. What do you think's bigger, climate change or habitat loss, or is it really a useless exercise to try to compare them like that?
Yeah, I think they kind of go together and they're overlapping each other. Our climate challenges as they move across the landscape are really going to affect a lot of different habitats in different ways. And one of the best ways that we can kind of fight against that is really looking at keeping whatever habitats we have out on the landscape intact and healthy. And here in Vermont, We have a lot of different birds that rely on those forest habitats. Here we go.
We have a lot of different birds that rely on these forest habitats.
On the forest habitats. And we have a lot of different landowners that own that land. So most of Vermont is privately owned. And so my work is focused a lot on reaching out to those landowners and having them think about how they connect with the land and how they can manage in a way that's going to be both friendly for birds and friendly for what they want to be able to accomplish on their land.
Yeah, that is a... landowners obviously play an important role here. And in fact, we had some folks on from the Vermont Land Trust and the Nature Conservancy a couple of weeks ago talking about developing a new wildlife corridor across Route 100 between Waterbury and Stowe for animals to be able to travel back and forth between two big forest blocks on either side of that Route 100 corridor. And my initial thought would be maybe that's not as important for animals that fly, like birds, as it is for animals that, you know, walk and otherwise get around on the ground. But it turns out that birds are very much in need of wildlife corridors as much as their four-legged friends are, aren't they?
Yeah, that Schutzville project is really amazing because it's connecting two huge forest blocks on either side of Route 100 there. And when I think about it and I look at it through a birder's eyes, there are a variety of different birds in there, from scarlet tanagers to all different sets of warblers to our state bird like the hermit thrush. They're going to be nesting there and breeding there. And then as we get into the migratory season, they're moving back and forth between different habitats as well. And so a lot of times we think that when it comes to crossing roadways, it's really about those larger animals. Like, I know I've pulled over there before and seen moose. You've probably seen moose moving through there. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times we miss the smaller animals that are moving across there. And those are the animals, they have a part in that food chain as well. And so, you know, we do have impacts from cars on birds. It's not as great as it is for some of our larger animals. But I think that project is not only doing great things for the larger mammals that are moving, but it's keeping those forests intact on either side of the road that are important for breeding birds as well.
Yeah, that's these are important considerations for folks to think about. David Mears, Audubon Society, came out with a report, was it last week, I believe, talking about the... climate change and the impact there on bird populations in Vermont, everything from, you mentioned the hermit thrush, Bridget, also the common loon I saw listed. What do we need to be thinking about there?
Well, let me go back to your question about habitat and climate, because what this report shows is that in North America, as many as two-thirds of our bird species are vulnerable to being pushed out of their range as a result of climate change. And in Vermont, it's even greater. It's as many as half of our bird species are vulnerable to being pushed out of their range, including pushed completely out of Vermont. So we might lose the common loon from the state, even after all the great work that people have put in to try to recover that amazing species. But it does connect to other threats, and one of the biggest threats to birds historically has been habitat loss. And one of the reasons we should care about the impacts of climate change is that it exacerbates all of those previous threats, all of the combined kinds of impacts that we've seen from land use changes or other kinds of threats like toxic chemicals and pesticides and the impacts on insects or birds that are eaten by cats. You know, there's a whole set of threats that climate change is probably the single greatest threat on top of all those. And so it requires us to double down on many of the ongoing efforts that we've had in place in this state.
Mm-hmm. You know, getting back to the Schutzville example, just because we were talking about it recently on the show here, one of the things that the Nature Conservancy and Vermont Land Trust folks were, and Stowe Land Trust folks were saying, on three folks on the show a couple of weeks ago, the spot where you want to put a wildlife corridor moves north with climate change. Mm. So, and they were talking about the wildlife corridor is tending to move north by, I think it was 11 miles every decade is the current projection. And I didn't really get to the question on that show because I didn't think of it in time, but I was thinking about it later, and it occurred to me that you could do a lot of great work to, say, get some landowners around either side of Route 100 near the Waterbury-Stowe town line to do some easements and preservation work and et cetera. And then 10 years later, you'd want to have the whole project happen again on the Stowe-Morrisville line, you know, just the next area north. Are we going to be running into this repeatedly in the coming decades, where we're going to be wanting to move our wildlife corridors farther and farther north?
Well, let me just jump in real quick, and then Bridget, I'm sure you'll have some additional insights. But first of all the wildlife corridors that are established now are not going to somehow no longer be valuable habitat. That will remain incredibly important habitat into the indefinite long-term future. The more we can invest in preserving forest blocks and all the habitat that goes with that, the better. But it does mean that we have to double down on some of those same practices and make sure that we accommodate and anticipate the changes in habitat that you're describing.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting about that is there's going to be a ripple effect from this Schutzville project. I think, especially if people start to zoom out and look, I don't know if you've ever played with Google Maps for your community before, but I encourage you to try it. You know, maybe we start with the folks that are in this region and you look at that Schutzville spot and you kind of zoom out and look at where the forests or the landscapes connect really well around where the development is, where all the people are. And what I like about working with landowners is once you turn one landowner on to something like this, they end up telling somebody else, right? Mm-hmm. So they're kind of helping me do my work by talking about it. It's that neighbor-to-neighbor chit-chat that happens. And then the stories that start to get told. So if you have somebody that's saying, oh, I did this, I created an easement, I'm seeing more wildlife move through my property because I'm starting to manage in a different way, or I'm seeing more birds on my property because I'm managing in a different way, that jazzes that person that you're talking to, and it can feed off of each other.
Let's go to a caller. Don from Elmore is on the line. Good morning, Don.
Good morning. My question is for both of your guests. My understanding is that I've always heard that the Audubon Society recommended feeding birds all year round and not a break in it because it discouraged them and also pull the food away when they might need it. Is that still the case? And then I've got a follow-up.
No, I think you may have you, the concept of not stopping once you've started feeding them is the right concept, so that part is correct. But it's important to take down the feeders in the spring. The time that having feeders up makes sense in terms of helping birds is during the winter months. If you have the feeders up in any other part of the year, there's a great threat of attracting bears. And at that point, there's actually a really rich amount of food, insects and berries and seeds and so forth. So, but once you've started feeding the birds in the winter, it's important to keep feeding them. Once they get acclimated to the feeders, you don't want to just pull that food source away. Bridget, did I get that right?
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, that's that thing of, you know, spring, October, you want to start taking, or you can put feeders out. Maybe we have to actually push that because of climate change now, right? The bears are staying awake a little bit longer, gathering the food that they need in order to fatten up before they go into hibernation. I would even say November now. So put your feeders up in November, take them down once we hit. Again, that's going to shift too with climate change. Bears are going to be waking up earlier as we see shorter seasons as well. So taking them down, then being consistent is really very important.
Well, let's take a look at another aspect of it too. The bears aren't just a problem with the bird feeders. They've been a problem with beehives for years. Mm. And in that situation, we simply put an electric fence around it. And that seems to do the trick. Why not put an electric fence around the beehives?
I mean, if you mean the bird feeders
and see if that'll cure the problem.
Well, there's just no reason. The birds have, in Vermont, we've got ample sources of food, insects, seeds, and so forth. So the birds really don't need bird feeders. And in some ways, there are certain risks with having birds, particularly in the warmer months. They may, having that density of birds may actually help spread certain kinds of diseases.
Yeah, so what I recommend folks do if they really enjoy having those birds in their backyard, and I know I do, my kids love to watch the birds at the feeder, is start to think about how can we landscape close to the home with different seed sources, berry sources, things like that. Bird baths are fine during the summer as well, and birds definitely need a source of water. So if you're feeling that heartache when you have to put the feeders away, consider some other opportunities to provide those ways for birds to feed and bathe and get what they need on your property so that you can still enjoy them through the window.
I do that, and the other thing I try to find is when I'm looking for new shrubbery find something that the birds can eat.
Right on.
And things on that sort of thing. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call, Don. Interesting perspective there. Don from Elmore caring about the birds around his place. That's great. We have Fred from Newbury on the line as well. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey, I'm wondering if, well, first of all, I want to know, when do birds know when to migrate? Is it the angle of the sun? And the other question is, are birds sensitive to high and low pressure systems, which would probably give a good idea of when they would start to fly? Would they hold up in a low pressure system and then continue to fly in a high pressure system?
Yeah, you got it. That's right. So birds are taking a number of different cues as the seasons change. So the availability of light cues them in. Also, as the food sources start to dwindle across the landscape. So, you know, we're enjoying foliage right now, that visual cue that fall is happening. But if you think about different birds, things going to seed, flowers starting to disappear, those are all cues, especially as the weather gets cooler, we see insect numbers start to drop. So those are all the things that start to cue birds in that it's time to leave. And you're right, they are going to take advantage of weather and pressure. If you're interested in this and you really want to geek out, one of the really cool things that you can do is look at weather radar at night. And you can actually see when the winds are coming from the right direction. And of course, that depends on whether you're migrating in the spring or the fall, right? You want that push winds from the north to push you south. You can look at weather radar and actually see the birds lifting off at night by reading different levels in the weather radar. And that can cue you in to go out the next day and look for different types of migrants. So birds are definitely paying attention to light cues, food cues, and depending on how the weather is, they're either going to take a break and rest and feed and fuel or take advantage of the winds and make a move.
So they're sensitive to changes in the barometric pressure.
Oh, you bet. I love watching that. There's birds in my backyard, especially like chickadees and nuthatches, that if I fine-tune my observation skills and spend time, I try to do a sit spot every day for about 20 minutes in my backyard, I can watch the behavior of these birds shift and change. They will disperse from where they're feeding in my yard when the pressure changes. And wouldn't you know it, if you look up, you can tell that there's like a storm coming or something. You can sometimes feel that as well. So the birds are definitely cueing into that and will change their behavior accordingly.
That is pretty amazing to think the birds are that sensitive to weather. They don't even have to watch the Weather Channel.
Yeah, know, birds can be your barometer, right?
Yeah.
It's really kind of cool. And the more you connect and the more you get to know the birds right in your backyard, the more you're going to be observant of these things as well.
Hmm. And if I could jump in too, just kind of tying the two questions together from these two callers, is that the building on something Bridget said, there's something all of us can do, which is to plant native plants in our backyard, plants that have seeds and berries and nuts, the kinds of things that are in the landscape around here that the birds have evolved to as a food source. It's awesome. I just, in my own backyard, I've seen the number of birds dramatically increase just by planting native plants. And if anyone's interested in that, Audubon Vermont has it, our website, a Plants for Birds page that you can go to and type in your zip code, and it will tell you what plants are good plants for your area and where to buy them.
Now, I have to confess, I put some netting over my blueberry plants this year.
That's okay.
Keep the birds off. I want the blueberries.
You got to share a little bit here and there, right? Or they do.
They can have the, what is it? There's another little tree out there that has berries on it. I'm trying to remember. Mountain ash has some nice berries, and I see that it does attract birds, and they seem to enjoy those. So birds, you can have the mountain ash. I'm keeping the blueberries. Thank you very much. Yeah. David Mears, I wanted to ask about, sort of zero in on the report that Audubon issued last week. What were its key findings and kind of the headline news from that effort?
Well, the part of it I've already described. You know, that there's for North America, generally there's 2/3 of our birds are vulnerable to the changes from climate change, both the shift in their habitat and the temperature increases, as well as a number of threats that are associated with climate change, like extreme weather events that we've seen here in Vermont, like flooding. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of birds, for instance, that nest in the spring in low-lying areas, and their habitat, their nesting habitat is lost from flooding. There's a lot of birds that if you have warm spring temperatures, it interferes with their nesting behaviors and the ability to raise broods of chicks. So there's a whole set of impacts and nationally and in Vermont as a result of the change in climate. So that was one of the key findings. The more optimistic side of it, though, it kind of models out into the future these different effects over the coming century, and it looks at both a higher level, about 3 degrees Celsius, or about 5 or 6 degrees Fahrenheit, as where we're headed. Mm-hmm. But the report also points out that if we're able to keep the warming at, if we kind of can reduce the amount of emissions and we hold warming at a degree and a half, which is where we're currently headed, then we can actually save 3/4 of those birds that would otherwise be at threat. So in that way, I found some real hope in the report and the opportunity and incentive for all of us, as gloomy as it may seem, if we act now and we act with deliberate intention, we can make a real difference for these birds and ultimately for ourselves.
Are there any bird species that Vermonters would like to see and would see more of as they move up from their current territories in, say, Pennsylvania and Virginia?
Maybe. And Bridget can speak more to this in more detail, but there's, at least when you look at the temperatures, it's possible, for instance, that, you know, we're already seeing more Carolina wrens in Vermont, that some of these birds that are historically have nested and lived south of us will shift north. But it's not a one-for-one kind of change, in that they also need very specific kinds of vegetation and habitat, and they have other needs that Vermont may not provide for them.
Hmm.
Yeah, I would agree. I know it's exciting to think about having some of those birds that are on the northern, you know, southern birds that are on the northern edge of their range that, you know, like trickle into Vermont every once in a while. I think about the excitement for prothonotary warblers or hooded warblers or things like that. The thing that worries me is the habitat going to be able to keep up with that, to be able to support those birds? So we're going to see a shift in the different types of tree and shrub species that we see across the landscape as things warm. And it's going to push some of our birds out. I mean, I think of some of the specialist birds that we love here that we brag about, like, you know, like the Grand Slam in the Northeast Kingdom of boreal birds. Those birds are specialists in like a spruce fir type of habitat. We're going to see less spruce across the landscape here. Mm-hmm. And so those birds are going to be out of our range. Things like boreal chickadees, spruce grouse is high vulnerability in this report. Black-backed woodpecker. I'm like trying to get all the five, the Grand Slam. So yeah. Oh my gosh, gray jay. I love gray jays. Those guys, especially those guys, they use their spit to kind of cache food in the wintertime. And what we're already starting to see with that bird is that the food that they're caching is now rotting because we have these warm spikes during the wintertime. As that changes, some of these birds that we hold really dear are going to move and shift and may not even just move north. They may be extirpated from the state as well.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
Like David said, that one-to-one payoff, am I going to be happy because I get to see hooded warblers now and I don't get to see Bicknell's thrush or boreal chickadees or hermit thrush?
Mm-hmm.
No, that's going to...
I would miss the hermit thrush for sure. I mean, that's such a beautiful call they have. That sound they make is just, wow.
That ethereal sound, that fluty sound that we hear in the woodlands.
Yeah, tremendous. And, you know, and obviously there are, I don't mean to make light of this stuff either. I mean, but you kind of have to ask the question of, as the climate changes and species here move north, one would assume that to some degree, and all this is incredibly variable, I understand, that other species would kind of move in to take their place, to some degree.
Well, and one of the things that we have observed about climate change already, that the global climate disruption is not linear.
Mm-hmm.
Tropical ice storm Irene is an example of the kind of extreme weather events that we're going to experience.
Yeah.
The incursion of species like the emerald ash borer, you know, these species, the woolly, adelgid.
Hemlock woolly adelgid.
That's going to take out our hemlock trees. These are things that are going to cause fairly substantial disruptions to our wildlife habitat and to our communities. Mm-hmm. It's important to link to this, the fact that these are indicators. The fact that we lose these birds isn't just the loss of the birds themselves. It's the loss of these habitats. It's the loss of our forest economy, our agricultural working landscape. There's a lot of impacts on humans that these changes, these impacts that are having on birds are going to have on us. We need clean water. We need clean air.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we forget, we call those ecosystem services, right? And like, there's that big so what, or what's in it for me? Like, who cares if there aren't any more birds? First of all, I challenge you to think of a day without birds. Like, how often do you step outside? It doesn't matter where you are, you have an interaction with birds. And if we think too about how that ties in, like David said, with our working landscape, healthy forests, healthy habitats, whether it's grassland or shrubland. We have a lot of people that rely on these things in different ways. And so birds are that hook, or I was thinking of it as like a talisman, right? Like, this is the thing that's telling us, right? Hashtag birds tell us. That's the Audubon hashtag for this project. And so birds are kind of telling us about this broader change that's going to happen. And we can look at them as a way that connects us with our local economy, our health. Man, I think of how much Vermonters really enjoy being outside and how that plays into our overall health and well-being as well. And so if birds disappear off the landscape, that means the habitat's being affected and it's going to trickle down to all these other little things.
Yeah, I mean, I almost hate to use the cliche canary in a coal mine.
Oh, please.
But, you know, we are absolutely facing a situation where birds can be that much of a, as you put it, a talisman or a signal, you know.
Yeah.
And certainly that's one of the reasons that we do want to pay attention and value our bird populations, is because of kind of what they mean in the larger context as well.
You know, and as suggested by the calls that we got from Don and Fred, this is a state in which people care deeply about birds. When they do surveys nationally about the level of interest in bird watching, Vermont is always at the top of the list.
Yeah.
We're a state where people like to be outdoors, and they know their birds, and the bird calls. It's mm-hmm. fun to be out in this state with folks, because for that very reason.
Talk to me a little bit about the about the economic impact there. I mean, obviously, a lot of there's bird tourism. I mean, bird groups go out and do birding, and then they stop somewhere for lunch. And is anybody really quantified all of that?
There are. I wish I had the top of my head the numbers, but there's a very significant fiscal economic benefit of bird watching in the state and mm-hmm. wildlife watching.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is also connected to all the other ways in which people come to the state or spend money in the state for outdoor recreation, whether it's our hunting and angling community. Mm-hmm. It's people who go come to, you know, this time of year to come look at the beautiful foliage, or that come to enjoy our hiking trails or burgeoning levels of mountain biking trails. We have a whole outdoor economy that's really growing in this state. And if we don't invest in protecting this beautiful place that we have, our green hills and silver waters, for our birds, it will also not be here for the tourists and others.
And for people who live here full time.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Hey, we're gonna take a brief break on the Dave Graham Show for some bottom of the hour news from CBS, a couple words from our sponsors. Going to continue our conversation with David Mears of the National Audubon Society's Vermont chapter, and with bird diva Bridget Butler. Another former Audubon person, lives in St. Albans and has been following Vermont's bird populations for a long time. So we'll be back with more of our conversation in just a couple minutes, folks.
Fall, the crisp, clear days, a harbinger of October's foliage to come. Upstairs at the Warren Store, our colorful clothing collection is as alluring and enticing as these lovely lingering autumn days. There's something for everyone. Activewear from cool Royal Robbins, Toad & Co., fashion-forward Tonya DeBellis, and comfy. Save the duck for warm, cozy, and ethically sourced. As always, our toy department delights. There's jewelry, accessories, and gifts galore, all upstairs at the funky, friendly, almost world-famous Warren Store in Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
And we are back, continuing our conversation with David Mears, the head of the Vermont chapter of the National Audubon Society, and Bridget Butler, the bird diva from St. Albans, is someone who's been following Vermont's bird populations for a long time and is an expert on all things aviary. Is that the right word?
Avian.
Okay. There we go. We were talking a little bit about, you can get into these conversations about climate change and about the environment in general and the future of our wildlife populations, and they can kind of veer off into the doom and gloom a little too readily sometimes. I wanted to talk about some thoughts and suggestions people are having for making the changes that are needed, and we do that. We get to do that sometimes on the show here. I mean, I was talking about the folks from the Schutzville Project, the Wildlife Corridor Project here in the Waterbury Stowe area. We're in a couple weeks ago, and clearly that's a project where I think that, you know, one of the lessons there is maybe human beings are evolving and starting to adapt to our environment, which organisms are supposed to do in evolutionary theory, right? I mean, that's one idea. But talk to us a little bit about what's coming, what's happening right now on this whole issue, the issues that were raised in particular in the Audubon report of last week, David Mears.
Well, let me just hit a few ideas, because this is a rich and deep and complicated area of conversation. Mm-hmm. When we're talking about climate change and the crisis, it connects to our economy, it connects to our energy use, it connects to the landscape. So there's a lots of different intersections. But to try to simplify it, there's a few three things that are kind of at the top of my list as I think about how we can make a difference here in Vermont. One is in our energy use. We need to think seriously about how we reduce the amount of fossil fuel usage we have in the state that we use for electricity, for heating, and for transportation. And it's those latter two, heating and transportation, that we really haven't sufficiently dealt with. A second category of work is looking at the way that we manage and live on the landscape. And we have this incredible land. We have forests, we have fields, we have the opportunity to store carbon and reduce the impacts of flooding and extreme weather events from climate all at once. So investing in our forests and protecting our working landscape is a critical piece of the puzzle. And then the third thing are the category of things that people can do in their own communities, whether it's their backyard and planting native plants, or it's being engaged through the local conservation district or planning commission or local government to have an input into how that community develops. Each one of those are really fundamental categories of work that we can do here in Vermont that anyone can do. Our state government is very accessible. Our local governments are accessible. And we, of course, have complete control over what we do in our backyards when it comes to planting plants. So I see some combination of those opportunities as things that can really make a huge difference here in Vermont, as well as advance our economic opportunities. There is no tension. There's no reason for combat between those who care about the ecological health and those who care about economic health of this state.
And I wondered in let's just take, you mentioned transportation, and habitat. Both of those things, it would seem, are connected with the idea of land use planning, because you know, one thing that will affect how far you have to commute is where people are building houses versus employment, you know, workplaces. So what's going on right now in Vermont in terms of trying to make changes in the way we do land use planning, and how will that help?
Well, I'll take a first stab at that at the statewide level. Bridget, maybe you could talk a little bit about what's going on in your communities, because I know there's a lot happening up in the St. Albans area that's really important work. But at the state level, we're at a really interesting moment. We're at the 50th, or right about at the 50th anniversary of Act 250, which is, of course, our state land use law, and it's had a profound effect on the way that we develop and live in the state. And we know it needs to be updated. There's significant ways in which it hasn't lived up to the promise of kind of really developing a planning structure that allows us to think about how we, exactly the question you've asked, Dave, you know, how do we live in communities and build walkable, livable communities and have accessible transportation, whether it's through personal vehicles or public transit. That really requires us to both think about how we protect the forested landscape and forest blocks and the undeveloped landscape, as well as how to promote and encourage more development in the existing settled areas. And right now there's a lot of really fascinating work being done in Montpelier by the Vermont legislature with the input of organizations in the environmental community, led in large part by the Vermont Natural Resources Council, to do some, there's some really exciting opportunities, I think, for us to update that law in a way that serve our interests, our economic interests, as well as address climate change.
We have a caller on the line, Joel from Colchester. Good morning, Joel.
Yes, and good morning, everybody. A very interesting program. I have just one quick little question, I guess principally for the bird diva, Bridget. Is it possible to delay and cause harm to hummingbirds by keeping one's hummingbird feeder up too long? The local birds seem to see that there's quite an abundance of nectar available right on my back deck. Would that in any way delay them from making the journey that they must make?
No, don't worry about it. I'm glad you're concerned about that, but I think what we also have to think about is we've got hummingbirds that were further north from us that are still migrating and still making their way down. So if you leave that feeder out, you're going to be providing a stopover spot for those birds that are coming from further north. It's really interesting to think of that being an all-powerful thing to stop the hummingbirds from going. But whenever we provide food in that way, whether it's seed or the nectar, it's really just a small amount of the bird's diet. They're getting food from other sources, but sometimes it is that crucial little piece. So if you have like a hard frost that happens or the weather shifts or changes, we get some of these bigger weather events that might affect the natural food sources that are out there. By providing that hummingbird feeder, that might help that one bird make it just a little bit farther to the next spot where there's some wild food sources available.
Okay, and all I can say is, wow, it's rare that I win an argument with she whom I on occasion argue. So.
No, you gotta disclose that before we go into, because then I soften the answer a little bit more when it's a dispute between couples.
Yeah, I don't know, that was a little dirty fool there, Joel.
One quick final comment that I thank you so very much.
All right, thanks.
It just seems that in the latter part of the season, the several little hummingbirds, and I guess they're male, that they seem to be spending a lot more time trying to chase each other away from the feeder than actually enjoying the abundant nectar, which I'm sure there's enough for many thousands of hummingbirds. I got a big feeder out there, but they do get very territorial, don't they?
Yeah, they are. So once, one hummingbird establishes that spot, and it can be with wildflowers as well, you can watch this behavior, whether it's by a feeder or whether it's in your garden, where the birds will protect that spot. If they have young in the area, that's the spot that they're going to bring their young to. And so it is kind of survival of the fittest there, and that food source is going to keep you fit.
Yeah, it's amazing how fast they can go. But anyway, thank you very much. Enjoying the program.
Thanks for the call, Joel. It kind of reminds me of how tough a certain fisherman I've known can be on a stream bank.
Oh, yeah, right? I think of backcountry skiers, too, protecting their little stashes here and there.
Yeah. Yep. So these behaviors we see in birds sometimes are... don't just blame the birds, folks. It's a cross-species phenomenon, let's put it that way. But let's go back to this conversation though about kind of steps that people are taking, can take, will take, should take, because we're trying to build a future in which we preserve the environment and we preserve our bird species. So, what other suggestions are out there for folks to be thinking about as we build the future of Vermont?
Yeah, so for birds, the thing that I keep thinking about right now, and we got a double whammy with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology report that came out 2 weeks ago about 3 billion birds lost in the past 50 years. So 3 billion individual, not species, but individual birds lost since 1970. And then the Audubon report comes out. Man, it can really feel like a sucker punch. And I think a lot of us, especially in Vermont, we're very aware, we're very connected with the land. It feels like, oh my gosh, just one more thing. But I think in that moment, you've got to recoup, regroup, and then really just double down. And so I'm really trying to think about what are the bold moves that I can start to make as an individual. And like David said, I start to think about those things that I can do at home. So whether it's adding more native species to my backyard, really thinking about how to remove invasive species, whether it's keeping my cat indoors, using less plastic, those things, those are those small things. And then I like to think, I'm starting to think out, like I know my city does not have a conservation commission, St. Albans City and St. Albans Town, they do have planning commissions. So how do I start to show up to those and think about ways to affect change, like climate change and habitat wise there? And then I start to think in this other circle a little bit farther out from me, and I start to think about on the state level. So what are the organizations like Audubon Vermont or VNRC that I can start to get involved with who I know are going to the state house and speaking about these things for me? How can I support those things? And if I even take a step further out, what can I do that's like national level stuff? What are those things that I can start to influence, whether it's by going to climate change action demonstrations, or if it's writing letters, things like that. So I'm talking about being bold. So it's like, it's double down. What are you doing now, and how can you take that one more step? And what's great is both the Audubon Vermont website and the Cornell Lab of Ornithology website have some great solid tips for people to take. And so I encourage everybody to start to think about that. What's that one more thing? David, you got to share that half earth thing that we were talking about. Remember when we were talking about half of this, half of that?
There's a really fascinating book written by a guy named Edward O. Wilson, who's an entomologist out of Harvard, who's also in his own way kind of a philosopher and ecologist.
He wrote Scientology, right? That was his big one back in the 70s, as I remember.
No,
not Scientology. No. What was the bit?
It was definitely not Scientology, though.
All right.
Anyway, but the most recent book, know which book you're thinking of. I just can't think of the name either. Yeah, but the most recent book is called Half Earth. And his basic premise is that at this time of unprecedented extinction, you know, we've, as others have talked about, we're in the middle of the sixth extinction, the sixth mass extinction. But unlike all the other ones that were caused by some natural cause, this is caused by people, one that's within our control to stop. And his point is, if we'd set aside half of the earth for wildlife and biodiversity, we have a chance of halting that extinction. And one of the ways in which that's begun to play out here in Vermont, led by a gentleman named Kurt Lindbergh, has been to talk about the ways that all of us can begin to set aside half of our backyard, half of our schoolyard, half of our condominium, you know, common area, half of the local community, half of the state. And it starts to be much more manageable as we start to think about setting aside half for biodiversity at that scale.
Wow, that is an interesting concept. I mean, and even there, where human beings are one of many species, is half too large a share for us. I mean,
yeah.
Take the logic and maybe even stretch it a little.
Oh, he's pushing it further. I love that.
Yeah, yes. I mean, it's just I like the point.
75%. Let's just go for it.
let's go to Dee in Duxbury. Sociobiology, I think, is the name of the book I was looking
for.
There you go. Okay. Dee in Duxbury, good morning, Dee.
Good morning. Speaking of percentages, can you give me the percent of birds lost? You know, a number doesn't mean anything, but what percent is that of the total population?
The population that has already been described, the 3 billion, I don't actually know what percentage that is. But I know looking forward that the modeling work that Audubon did suggests that two-thirds, you know, 65, 66% of the birds that exist in North America today are likely to have been pushed out of their range. And for Vermont, the number's higher. It's more like it's a little bit lower, I should say. It's about 50%. But Bridget, do you have a sense of the overall percentage?
Yeah, so here's another way to think about it. And this comes from a really interesting graphic after the 3 billion birds lost. New York Times did a piece, and they took some of the data together, and they figured it out this way. So there's, as we have more people, we have fewer birds. So one of the graphics that they made was, if you thought about it back in 1970, which was when I was born, there were 45 birds for every person in both countries. So this study looked at birds across the continental U.S. and Canada, so combined. So in the United States and Canada in 1975, there were 45 birds for every person. And now as we move into 2018, we're talking about a 29% loss, and that means there's 20 birds for each person in both countries. So that's another way to kind of think about it. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology's website, if you just Google 3 billion birds lost, there are some wonderful visual graphics that can help you kind of grapple with some of these numbers. But we're looking at 29 to a 30% loss of birds since 1970.
Does that help put it in better perspective, Dee?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, that's great. Claudia, thank you for the call. David Mears, I wonder if you could comment, and then Bridget Butler, I'll ask you as well. A lot of these issues with birds can actually be stretched way beyond your backyard to an international basis.
Absolutely, and Bridget can be more specific, but there are many birds that come through Vermont that winter in South America and Central America. Mm-hmm. It's quite incredible to see, you know, a bird that was banded here in Vermont, a golden-winged warbler that actually made its way all the way from Costa Rica or someplace far south. So yes, and the birds don't know from borders, and we need to think systematically and systemically. And it's easy in that context also to start to, that's another thing I often hear from folks is, what can Little Vermont do? And it can feel hopeless. But there are definitely systematic changes that we can make. We can look at our energy systems. We can think about putting a price on carbon. There are lots of ways in which we and our small state can model behaviors and set an example for instance, how we manage our forests that can be models for the rest of the country.
Let's go to Bridget. Do you want to add something?
Yeah. More? So, you know, one of the things that that I like to talk about with landowners too, and with anyone, is really understanding the value of place and this place that we live in. When I talk to landowners, one of the things that I love to share with them, and this comes from the organization called Hollow to Canada, which works with landowners along the northern part of the Green Mountains and a set of towns up there, is that we are part of the largest intact northern temperate forest in the entire world.
Yeah.
So in the entire world. So we play this really core part in keeping this very particular forested type of habitat intact and healthy and on the landscape.
You're talking about extending from what, the Adirondacks over to Maine up into Canada, right?
Yeah, all the way up into Canada. And yep. So you blow apart all those borders and you start to think about, man, Vermont has this really significant role to play in protecting that habitat, which then bleeds over right into all of these different species. So whether you're a birder or you like tracking or you like reptiles and amphibians, there's a whole set of animal species that rely on that intact northern temperate forest here.
A couple callers on the line. Let's see if we can get them in quickly because we're running out of time. But Steve from Moortown, you've been waiting. Good morning, Steve. Maybe not there. Okay, how about Lynn from Brookfield?
I'm here.
Oh, we got somebody.
We got Steve from Moortown?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Morning. Good. I was wondering if any consideration is going into the magnetic bird reversal that's going on with our thing right now, with our world, and how that's affecting the birds, because they do have magnets in their noses, and they use those to migrate with, and maybe they're going to someplace else rather than coming to Vermont anymore because the magnetic pole is shifting.
The magnetic pole is shifting. What do we know about this?
Yeah, I don't know much about the magnetic pole. I do know that as habitats, right, so that pull is probably pretty consistent throughout their flight. But the other big piece that we forget about is the need for stopover sites. And I think that's the other piece that often kind of shifts where birds are going to, what their migration path is going to be. We live along the Atlantic Flyway, and as habitat is fragmented and decreases along that flyway, it makes it harder for birds to make that migratory route. I don't know a lot about magnetic poles. I think that's something to look at and to consider.
All right. Well, lots of questions here. And unfortunately, we are about out of time on this edition of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. I want to thank my guest very much, David Mears of the National Audubon Society Vermont's chapter, and Bridget Butler, Bird Diva, based in St. Albans. The two of you, thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And that's about it for the Dave Graham Show on this Monday morning. Stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio. We'll be back tomorrow morning with another edition of our program, and check us out then, folks. Have a great day. In the meantime, everybody.